on behalf of myself and Deacon Ed Krasinowski, and on behalf of all the priests present here, Father Brian Clark and Father Roger Soli, Father Pete Aliotta, Monsignor John Brady, Father Mike King, I want to extend to the whole Doran family, especially to Jean and to Kathy and Mike and Eileen and Sheila and Mitko and John and Melody and Mary and Mark, and to Bea and Scott and to Leah, to Nancy and Ron, and to Basil and Rhett, our sincerest condolences, and the pledge of our prayers, and the promise that John will be remembered in this community and in many others, and that we will continue to pray for him and remember him. Remember him on the anniversary of his death. Remember him on the Feast of All Saints and All Souls. Remember him in the month of November when we remember the deceased of our parish. Remember him at the entrance of our church where his name will be on the board there, recalling those who have gone ahead of us. We are filled, all of us, with a sense of loss of this wonderful guy who had really inspired us by his life and given us joy. And we thank the family for sharing him with us. Eileen read that reading from the book of Ecclesiastes, and in many ways I think it captures John in his life and in his work. He has put into our hearts the timeless without men's ever discovering it. From beginning to the end, the work which God has done, and I have recognized that there is nothing better than to be glad and to do well during life. For every man, moreover, to eat and to drink and enjoy the fruit of his labor as a gift from God. That was certainly John, someone who was glad, who did well during in this life, who enjoyed the fruit of his labor and saw it as a gift of God. And his awareness of that gift was a gift to all of us. There are some people who change your life, and John Doran was one of those who changed mine. And not just mine, but many other people's lives. He changed the life of his children, of his co-workers and his employees, of his friends and associates, of his fellow parishioners. And he changed and continues to change the life of hundreds, maybe thousands of children and youth who will never even know his name and never meet him. In parishes and schools all around our region, he is changing lives. I spoke to the young people in the junior class at McNamara High School last Friday, the day that John died, and I mentioned him to them, and I talked about his life as an inspiration to them. And they benefit from their Fine Arts Center, which was a gift from John and his foundation. John continues to change lives in the development of people's talents and abilities, in the help to them to grow in virtue and in confidence, and in the creation of community and love in so many places, and in the passing on to other generations of the values and the joy and the optimism that he shared, this joyful son of Aaron. John continues to change lives. And what a life his was. It started in another era, really, when life was different. Born in 1923 in Newark, New Jersey, Father Brian is probably one of the few people that knew him in those days, in that era. He was raised by his mother, Beatrice. He never knew his father, and so his mother was the dominant influence and force in his life. Today we might call him a latchkey kid. His mother was a domestic worker. She cleaned people's houses for a living. She could make anything there was out of cloth. A seamstress could take scraps of cloth and make clothing out of it. John might well have grown up on the streets of Newark, New Jersey, and who knows what might have happened to him, but somehow he was influenced by the church and by his community of faith. And he found in the church a place of refuge, a place where he could be involved in the plays, in the drama. And so he wanted to see a theater here, a place where he could play basketball. And so he wanted to see a gym here. He was an ambitious and cheerful little kid. You could just picture him as this kind of pixie, shining shoes on the streets of Newark, New Jersey. He used to shine shoes for 10 cents a shine. And some of the tougher customers, and there were tough customers in Newark, New Jersey, no doubt, those days. He was one of these little kids. They even let him go into the bars and shine shoes there. And you could just picture him snapping that cloth and making cheerful talk, because he knew that the more he talked and the harder he worked, the bigger the tip. John's mother was a very disciplined person and very religious. And she instilled in him a love of God, a love of prayer, a love of the church, a love of his brothers and sisters in Christ. They also shared life with a broader family, the other kids in the neighborhood in New Jersey, where he played kick the can on the streets. And the trips down to the Jersey shore, to Lawrence Harbor, where they stayed in a tiny little shack at the shore with all of the kids in the extended family and from the neighborhood. In some ways, when he was 7 or 8 or 9, it must have looked like a casting for the Our Gang comedy. All these tough little street kids from Newark, New Jersey, who enjoyed each other's company. When he was 12, he went back to Ireland with his mother. His mother was an immigrant from Ireland, and rode across much of Ireland. He rode from wherever it was that they got off the boat by bicycle to Cavan, where she was from. In fact, toward the end of his life, he and I talked about doing that, but we never did that. We never got back to Cavan. And he talks about that memory of being with his mother, riding across Ireland. A memory of love, a memory emblazoned in his own life. He got a big break in life when he went to Seton Hall High School in Newark, and he graduated from there in 1941. And there he got a kind of broader vision of the world, and he saw maybe for himself the possibilities for his own life. He went to the Merchant Marine at Kings Point, and he was in the Merchant Marine Academy during World War II. And for part of the time in World War II, he was on ships in the Pacific going to the Philippines. And I wonder if he was, as they were offloading materials for the troops in Leyte Gulf, which is just where the Tacloban, where the terrible hurricane or typhoon hit this past week. I wonder if he ran into my father, who was there offloading those ships at the very same time. At the end of World War II, John was always resourceful. At some point, evidently, Father Edmund Walsh, I looked it up, it was probably Father Edmund Walsh, from Georgetown came and spoke at the Merchant Marine Academy, and I guess he had said to them, if you boys want to go to Georgetown, you come see me. And so John took him literally. And so he was in Baltimore. He was in port on a Merchant Marine ship, and he hitchhiked from Baltimore to Georgetown, and he rang the doorbell at the Jesuit residence and talked to Father Edmund Walsh, who was Dean of the School of Foreign Service, and he got in. Try that today with Georgetown. He went there on the GI Bill, and he went through the School of Foreign Service. And while he was at Georgetown, always a resourceful kid, he had all the tools of his trade from the Merchant Marine. He was skilled. He was not afraid of big machines, having worked with those big boilers and things like that on ships. He even started a little class at Georgetown. He would lend out tools to his fellow students. A lot of them were older students, students on the GI Bill, people who had been in the service. And a lot of them didn't know how to use the tools, so he started a little class called You Can Do It, You Do It. And he trained them how to use the tools. He saw opportunities everywhere. And while he was at Georgetown, he also worked at night as a maintenance man at Garfield Hospital, up where the Washington Hospital Center is today. He had a certificate for steam boiler maintenance. He was on the night shift there at Garfield Hospital, and on the night shift was also a nurse who seemed to have a lot of trouble with her sink on that floor. It got clogged up, and this young maintenance man had to come up and unclog it, and then it got clogged up again the next night, and the maintenance man had to come back and came back a third night. And finally he caught on that this young nurse, Jean Kerrigan, was clogging up that sink so the maintenance man would have to come back. And finally, men can be a little slow on the uptake. He asked her out. And I think they went together, what, 3 years? 2 or 3 years? A long time. Anyway, finally she had to say to him, either ask me to marry you or move on. So he asked her to marry him. He was 29, she was 26. And they were married at St. James Church in Falls Church. And they began their family life together in Tacoma Park. Now, there are various legends on how he started his company, but we talked about this. There was one day there was a big storm, and a lot of trees fell down, and a lot of tree branches were down. And John, never afraid of risk, wrote a big check to Montgomery Ward's and bought out all the chainsaws there. And he rented out those chainsaws over the weekend. John Jr. told me it was a Friday, and he wrote a bad check on a Friday. But he knew that they couldn't cash it till Monday, so he rented out the chainsaws over the weekend, and so Monday morning he had the money to cover the check and rented out tools from his car. And gradually his business grew. I told the story last night at the wake about, he told me that, and I don't know if this is true or not, but that as the Italians say, if it's not true, it's well said. Anyway, he only had to fire one person in his business. That was his mother. Because early on in the business, he would be busy delivering tools and servicing customers, and she was taking the phone calls at their house in Silver Spring, I guess, by that time, and she'd say, oh, no, he couldn't possibly do it. He's way too busy. The man's working himself to death. And so he'd come home and found she was turning away business. He said, Mom, you can't turn away business. So he had to fire her and get somebody else to answer the phone. He was an innovator, and maybe John will talk a little bit more about that in his business. He was really an innovator. He was a creative person. And he admired the catalogs of companies like Sears, and he developed his own catalogs, and he would get the kids to run out and hand the catalogs to bulldozer drivers and people like that on construction sites to distribute these catalogs. Eventually, his business grew from that humble start to 26 stores in 6 states. A real achievement for anybody in life. Wonderful thing. But his big achievement, and the thing that I think he took most pride in, was being paterfamilias, being the father of the family. And together with Jean, they had 10 kids in 16 years. Kathy, Eileen, and Sheila, John, Mary, Charlie, Bea, Leah, Nancy, and Danny. It must have been quite a lineup when everybody had to line up. He went through, I'm told, like a lot of it happens in a lot of big families, he went through all the names when he was trying to figure out who he was talking to. Together with Jean, they were part of a group of big families at Blessed Sacrament Parish in Chevy Chase. They formed a club there called 7-Up. You had to have 7 or more children to get into the club. And their house became a center of activity in the neighborhood. With all those kids, there was always somebody hanging around. There was always something going on. And you could see how the neighborhood kids would like to be there, because that was the place where there was activity. They moved to Calvert County in 1975. Jean wanted to move to the country, wanted to have a garden. She was concerned about life in the city there and thought this would be a better atmosphere. John traveled a lot to big equipment exhibitions in Germany and Japan and all over the world. He wanted his company to be a leader in equipment. He sold a lot of equipment. He figured out how to buy used equipment and repair it and sell it to places like Latin America. But he was very much a hands-on father. They always had family dinner. Like my family, they had a cowbell that called people to dinner. And the kids had to come running. If you wanted to eat, you would come running. And he was an organized father. I think the most interesting thing about him was this composition book idea. Every kid had their own composition book. And in it, you had to write down important things, essays, atonement. John mentioned there was a time when he evidently set a bamboo field on fire. John and his dad made him explain, just how did the matches get into your hand? And each kid had to write down their little agreements that they made with their dad. If they wanted something, he'd say, well, I'll make a deal. I'll pay half of it. You have to earn the other half. And here's how you earn it. And they'd write the deal, and they'd write a contract out, and they'd have to sign it. You should save those composition books. Those will be a cherished memory. And all of the kids had their duties and chores. They made Kathy read articles out of the Wall Street Journal at the dinner table, and then they had to discuss current events. And all of the kids had their jobs to take care of one another. In some ways, dinner was like a kind of press conference or an interview. And I guess the most difficult interviews for the girls was when their dates would come to the house, and John would call the dates into the house and make the boys sit down uncomfortably in the parlor. I can see that was a kind of squirming moment. And he'd say, so tell me, young man, what will you be doing 5 years from now? And all the boy wanted to do was get to the dance. But a good question, and a question we should all think about. John was always looking to the future. That's why he had the children write out their goals. He was a father who gave all of his kids lots of rope, but there were some things that were so important to him. Telling the truth was important to him. Being present was important to him. His children were critically important to him. And surely the saddest year of his life was 1985, when Charlie and Danny died. I think that that left a shadow over his years, and why it's important to him that he be buried here next to his mother and to his boys. You know, John was very specific when he picked out his grave in that cemetery over here. He said, "I want it close to the curb." I said, "Why do you want it close to the curb?" He said, "Because when people park their cars, they'll see my stone and they'll remember to pray for me." As he got older, he relaxed a little bit more. I think we all do as we get older. We learn that life shouldn't be taken too seriously. There should be moments of joy. I'm talking to the family the other day. One time he would do silly things occasionally. When Nancy was filming him one time, his pants fell down. And he loved gadgets. He loved anything that he could adjust and improve. He bought a Mercedes one time, and a diesel Mercedes, and put two tanks in it so they could have 1,000-mile range on the car. And he loved his family. I think above all, he loved his family. And sometimes, as the father of the family, he used them. Once he got stopped by a policeman, and as the cop was coming to the car, he said, "I want you kids to cry." "All you kids to cry. So when that policeman gets here." So when the policeman got up to the window, all the kids are in the back seat screaming. And the policeman says, "Well, I see you got your hands full. You better..." He was a person that I think always recognized the value of work, but he always recognized that what you were working for was those moments of celebration and joy. What you were working for was the opportunity to give your life back to God. We saw him here at Mass frequently in Lent, even on weekdays, and every Sunday. He always was in church. He said his prayers every night. He was personally devout. He was scrupulously honest. To John, when people shook hands on a deal, that was the deal. I remember one time I went with him. We were going to buy some land for the parish, and he said he would buy it for us. We went into the lawyer's office. And he wasn't afraid of taking risk. He said that we walked into the lawyer's office, and he said to the lawyer, "Before you open your mouth, I want to tell you I'll give you 110% of the appraised value of that property." And the lawyer said, "Well, I don't guess I have anything to say, do I?" And so the deal was done. But then we got home, and the heirs thought, I guess, of this estate that we were buying, "Well, maybe he'll give a little, if he'll give 110, maybe he'll give 120. So they wanted to renegotiate it, and I was the only time I ever saw John angry. He said, "You tell that guy a deal is a deal." And we shook hands on it. And that was the deal. That's what we concluded. He was a man of absolute integrity. And he meant what he said, and his word was his bond. And I think people doing business with him knew that. I really didn't get to know him very well until we went to the Holy Land in 1997, and John and Jean were on that trip. He liked to be the last person on the plane or the bus. He didn't see any point sitting on the plane when you can sit out in the lounge and stretch your legs. And so I, since I was always trying to be the last one on so that I'd be sure everybody got on, he and I would sit there in the lounge or waiting for the plane or the bus. And so we got an opportunity to talk on that trip. And I came to know him as a man of big vision. I remember one discussion we had, I think we were waiting for the plane to, flying from the Holy Land to Italy, and he said, "What should I, I'm going to be selling my business, what should I do in retirement?" And I said, "Well, John, you raised 10 children, so maybe you should do something that has to do with youth. Maybe youth in our area in southern Maryland, because you know that there isn't all that much for them to do after they get out of school." It was shortly after that that he founded his Doran Family Foundation, and he began with his idea about creating these centers for youth and families all over our area. And he has left an impact on so many parishes, on Jesus the Good Shepherd, Jesus the Divine Word, our parish, St. Aloysius in Leonardtown, St. John's in Hollywood, Bishop McNamara High School, St. Elizabeth Ann Seton High School. I'm sure I'm leaving some out, many others. Many faith communities have been the beneficiary of his generosity and his concern for youth. And I expressed a concern to him one time. I said, "John, do you think it's, I mean, you're giving away all this money, do you think that this is a good thing? Yeah, what about your family?" And, you know, he said, "Listen, Father, I came into this world with nothing and I'm going out the same way." He loved his family, he cared for his family, but he had a broad vision. He had the broader vision, the broadest vision of any person I've ever met. He wasn't afraid to think the big thoughts and to dream the big dreams. We were being very cautious here when we built the church, and I remember all this discussion about which we should build first, the church or the Family Life Center. Finally, we decided on the church, and he agreed with that, but he was getting anxious. He said, "Listen, Father, I'm not getting any younger. We got to get started on this thing." So after the church was opened, we looked at this, and the finance council said, "Well, gee, I don't know if we can afford all of that." So we said, "Maybe, John, if you could do a little bit more on this building, we could get started because of the we can do the site work." But so we agreed that we would meet at Ruby Tuesday's, one of his favorite restaurants, because it had a buffet, and we would talk about it. So I think it was Jean Carroll and I and went to dinner at Ruby Tuesday. And I think when Jean got up to go to the restroom or something, it was before the waitress came, I said to John, "You know, we're hesitating because we're not sure we can afford all of this." And he said, "Oh, it's okay. I'll take care of it." He said, "The whole thing?" He said, "Yeah, the whole thing," which was a whole lot more money, several hundred thousand more. And then the waitress came to take the order, and he turns to me and says, "Do you want to split the baked potato? Because they're big here, and we know no point in buying two of them." He didn't choke at a few hundred thousand more dollars, but that second baked potato was During those days, we traveled around this area, Annapolis, Baltimore, Washington, other places, looking at gyms and theaters, talking about the design. And I got to know him, too, on those car rides. He was a person with deep love for the church and a good sense about how kids could be raised with opportunities and activities. He said to me one time, we were planning this Family Life Center, he said, "Listen, Father, Catholic boy meets Catholic girl and makes Catholic family. That's not a bad thing." That was part of his hope for the Family Life Center and for all of these places that he was giving himself to. He was a person that didn't really care anything about his own comfort or trying to impress other people. He was very concerned about others. I remember during the scandals of 2002, when it was a shameful time for a lot of priests. All of the stories on the news were about scandal in the church. And I was very upset one day at weekday mass, and he happened to be there. So he called me later in the day and said, come meet me for lunch. So I met him for lunch. He said, I just want to know how you're doing. I thought, what a wonderful sign of love that he could see the concern on somebody's face and that he was aware of it and that he reached out to somebody. I think one of his happiest days was his 50th anniversary, when he and Jean renewed their vows and could come together again and celebrate the fruits of their labor and the joy of their family and friends. He had an unshakable confidence in the goodness of God and that all would be well, that God would be with him so long as he kept his eye on heaven. And he was right. God was with him all those days. He had the confidence that comes from a faith that is tried early on in life. He had the confidence that comes from a life that was given to God in goodness and in prayer. He loved God, I think, in that kind of natural way that, you know, Irish spirituality is a kind of natural spirituality. It's based in the beauty of nature and in relationships with God and with people. It's very Trinitarian. And an awareness that God's grace is everywhere. As Gerard Manley Hopkins said, that the world is charged with the grandeur of God, that it'll shine out like shining from shook foil. And I think John saw the grandeur of God in life, in the cry of a baby, in the joy of children, in the success and challenge of work, the opportunity to serve God in so many ways. And he's inspired so many people. I think he took some of his inspiration from the prayer of St. Patrick, who said, I arise today through God's strength to pilot me, God's might to uphold me, God's wisdom to guide me, God's eye to look for me, God's ear to hear me, God's word to speak for me, God's hand to guard me, God's way to lie before me. Christ be with me, Christ be before me, Christ be behind me, Christ be within me, Christ be beneath me, Christ be above me, Christ on my right, Christ on my left, Christ when I lie down, Christ when I sit, Christ when I arise, Christ in the heart of every man who thinks of me, Christ in the mouth of everyone who speaks to me, Christ in the eye of everyone who sees me, Christ in the ear of everyone who hears me. John was like that. He saw the goodness in people. He saw Christ in them. He saw endless possibilities. I arise today through a mighty strength, through the invocation of the Trinity, through belief in threeness, through the confession of the oneness of the Creator of creation. God gave you to us, John, and now we give you back to God.